And he starts off with a statement that's interesting enough. Here, as in everything else, the way must be prepared for your moral assault by darkening his intellect. Before you can really mess with his spirit, you have to confuse him. He's got to be confused before we can really deal with it. So let's make sure that we're not confused about it as we move on. And next he says, men are not angered by mere misfortune, but my misfortune conceived is injury. And the sense of injury depends on the feeling that a legitimate claim has been denied. Okay, now, think about that. Tree falls on your car, you're like, crap. That sucks. That is a horrible twist of fate, and life sucks, and I hope my insurance pays for it. You're not mad at the tree. You're not mad at the storm. It happens. But if that insurance company that you paid the premiums to all those years is like, oh no, that's not covered because we don't cover elm trees because elm trees had a blight last year. And if you check the writer that we sent out in the mail, paragraph 7, we excluded elm trees from storms that happened in months that have a vowel in them. Okay, then you go ballistic, okay? Because then you've been injured. It's not something happened. Then somebody they are trying to stick it to you. And you know that you deserve to be paid. You deserve to have your claim paid, your car repaired, whatever. Whatever you think your insurance policy should cover, you know it should be paid. And if they're trying to stick it to you, you know that's wrong. And it drives you ballistic. Right? Okay. So, next slide. They anger him because he regards time as his own. He's talking about people who make plans and you change their plans, or people who go to him and ask him to do things, and how that upsets him. And he is, at this point, he's not so uncharitable to get angry at, but he's starting to get annoyed by it. And he is angered because he regards his time as his own and feels that it is being stolen. You must therefore zealously guard in his mind the curious assumption that my time is my own. And let him have the feeling that he starts each day as the lawful possessor of 24 hours. Okay? Next slide. You have a delicate task here. The assumption which you want to go on making is so absurd that if once it is questioned, even we cannot find a shred of argument in its defense. When I speak of preserving the assumption in his mind, therefore, the last thing I mean you to do is furnishing with arguments in its defense. There aren't any. Your task is purely negative. Don't let him think about it. Because if he thinks about it, he'll realize, I don't own my time. It's not mine. I can't lay claim to it. Don't let his thoughts come anywhere near it. Wrap a darkness about it. In the center of that darkness, let his sense of ownership and time lie silent, uninspected, and operative. Make sure he doesn't think about the fact that he doesn't own his time. Why? That's a good question. The man can neither make nor retain one moment of time. It all comes to him by pure gift. He might as well regard the sun and moon as his chattels. Chattels is basically cattle. They might as well regard the sun and moon as his livestock. He also is committed to a total service of the enemy. And if the enemy appeared to him in bodily form and demanded total service, even for one day, he would not refuse. If God himself showed up and said, I need you for the next 24 hours. Okay, so much for my plans. Fine. He would be greatly relieved if that one day involved nothing harder than listening to the conversation of a foolish woman. Because, you know, it could be like, go to Africa and die. I need you to be a martyr in, you know, China. Go preach the gospel for about 23 hours, and then the 24th hour you're going to die. Well, is there a way that you can take this cup from me? Nope, tried that one. It's worth a good question. Yeah, I asked it myself. Well, okay. No harm. He would be relieved to almost a pitch of disappointment if for 1.5 hour in that day, the enemy said, now you may go away and amuse yourself. Now, you got a 1/2 hour. Go do something. I don't care what. Really? I got a 1/2 hour free time? Ooh. Does that line up with Scripture? Yeah. Daniel proclaimed to King Belshazzar, right before Belshazzar died, the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways. Remember, Belshazzar was having this great party, and this ghostly hand appeared and wrote this line on the wall, Mene, Mene, Uparshin, Tekel. And Belshazzar called Daniel in and said, Daniel, what does this mean? And Daniel was like, well, it basically means you're going to die. Screwtape goes on to say, and this is a wonderful metaphor, it's as if a royal child whom his father has placed for love's sake in a titular command of some great province under the real rule of wise counselors should come to fancy he really owns the cities, the forests, and the corn in the same way as he owns the bricks on the nursery floor. Do we own anything? Do we own our time? Do we own our days, our hours, any of that? And then it ends with the like most awesome line of the entire letter. In the long run, either our father or the enemy will say mine of each thing that exists, and especially of each man. They will find out in the end, never fear, to whom their time, their souls, and their bodies really belong, and certainly not to them, whatever happens. In the end, we will hear either God say mine, or Satan will say mine. And our time is not our own. I would much rather it be God's. When we get to letter 20, these Roman numerals are getting kind of frustrating. Letter 22. And this is the letter I call the most delightful letter. There's not much to it, but it's so much fun. Because the patient has gotten a girlfriend. He's gotten a girlfriend, and it's just so much fun because she is a Christian, and not only a Christian, but such a Christian. The little brute, she makes me vomit. We'd have had her to the arena in the old days. That's what her sword is made for. Not that she'd do much good there either, two-faced little cheat who looks as if she'd faint from the sight of blood and then dies with a smile. He is just insane with rage. It's so funny. He can't even contain himself. He's so outraged at this girl. he continues, and he's the next, cheating every way. Looks as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth, and yet has a satirical wit. The sort of creature who'd find me funny. Filthy, insipid little prude. Yet really ready to fall into that booby's arms like any other breeding animal. Why doesn't the enemy blast her for it if he's so moonstruck by virginity instead of looking on there grinning? I mean, it's just comical. Basically, this girl is in love, and they're having a physical relationship, and the devil is like, they're fooling around. She's not going to be virgin long like that, is she? And sits there and says, God's just doing nothing, isn't he? Why doesn't he strike her dead? Well, why doesn't he? Well, because he endures our sin. Not because he doesn't endure our sin, but he loves us. And it's not that they're sinning. Remember, they've already said that his attacks on chastity have stopped. And you can tell that however much he might want to make this girl promiscuous, she's not. Okay? This girl is a good girl. This Screwtape is outraged that she is such a good girl. It's so outraged that it's funny. I love how incredibly, insanely angry he is. And then he starts talking about God. All right? Because when he turns around, part of why he's so angry is because Wormwood tried to get Screwtape in some kind of trouble. He sort of ratted him out and said, some unguarded expression in one of my letters has tried to get him in trouble over someone. But that trouble has been tided over. And Screwtape says, you shall pay for that as well as some of your other blunders. I'll settle with you presently. You have always hated me and been insolent when you dared. So he's already fired up. Devil, fired up. Ironic. Anyway. But as outraged as he is, he goes on to talk about God, and he says, why doesn't he just burn them all for even lapsing at all? Because he's a hedonist at heart. He loves pleasure. He's a hedonist at heart, Wormwood. All those fasts and vigils and stakes and crosses are only a facade, or only like the foam on the seashore. Out at sea, out in his sea, there is pleasure and more pleasure. He makes no secret of it. At his right hand are pleasures forevermore. He's quoting Psalm 16. And he continues and says, he's vulgar, Wormwood. He has a bourgeois mind. It's a fancy French way of saying he's middle class. He's so middle class. He's so middle class, I'm going to use a fancy French word to describe him. He has filled his world with pleasures. There are things for humans to do all day long without his minding the least. Sleeping, washing, eating, drinking, making love, playing, praying, working. Everything has to be twisted before it's of any use to us. We fight under cruel disadvantages. Nothing is naturally on our side. Nothing. You see what we have to work with. And that is true, because we can see in James chapter 1, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren, every good gift and perfect gift is from above and comes down from a Father of lights, with whom there is no turning or no variation of shadow or turning. Excuse me. He then turns and talks about this woman's family, and their family is a Christian family. Their whole house exudes Christian values. The whole house and garden are one vast obscenity. It bears a sickening resemblance to the description one human writer made of heaven, the region where there is only life, and therefore all that is not music is silence. Okay? The region where there is only life, and therefore all that is not music is silence. Okay? That is from a writer whose name is George MacDonald. Anybody ever heard of George MacDonald? Anybody? George MacDonald was one of the guys who really drove, there's an echo, drove Lewis and Tolkien and all that crowd into their writing, because he was writing Christian fiction about 50, 60 years before they were. He wrote books that were really, really profound. Lewis said, "I've always considered him my master." How many of you ever heard of Dante's Divine Comedy or Dante's Inferno? Okay, it's a Renaissance work where the Italian poet Dante gets guided on a trip through hell, purgatory, and ultimately heaven. He's taken through hell by the I just completely lost who his guide was. I just completely forgot who takes him through. Virgil. Virgil, the Roman poet Virgil, takes him through hell, and shows him all the different layers of hell and points out why these people are here and gives him this guided tour of hell. Well, when Lewis decided to write his version of that, he called it The Great Divorce. And he has this dream where he's given a tour of hell, which is not at all like you might expect it. And then he gets on a bus, and the bus goes to heaven, and has this experience where he's walking in sort of the outskirts of heaven, and he meets a guide, and the guide shows him around heaven. Well, the guide is actually George MacDonald, okay? That's how highly he esteemed MacDonald. This is taken from a book called Unspoken Sermons, and it is from a sermon called Hands of the Father. And he says, "Nor shall we ever know that repose in the Father's hands, that rest of the Holy Sepulchre, which the Lord knew when the agony of death was over, when the storm of the world died away behind his retiring spirit, and he entered the regions where there is only life, and therefore all that is not music is silent. For all noise comes of the conflict of life and death. We shall never be able, I say, to rest in the bosom of the Father till the fatherhood is fully revealed to us in the love of brothers." Okay? So basically, talks about noise as being conflict. And then Screwtape rages on about noise and how awesome it is. And he says, "Music and silence, how I detest them both. How thankful we should be ever that ever since our father entered hell, no square inch of infernal space and no moment of infernal time have been surrendered to either of these abominable forces, but all has been occupied by noise. Noise, the grand dynamism, the audible expression of all that is exultant, ruthless, and virile. Noise, which alone defends us from silly qualms, despairing scruples, and impossible desires. We will make the whole universe a noise in the end." And he gets so worked up, so fired up, that he literally transforms into a giant centipede. It says, "Here the manuscript breaks off and is resumed in a different hand." And it says, "In the heat of composition, I find that I've inadvertently allowed myself to assume the form of a large centipede. I'm accordingly dictating the rest to my secretary." He makes some comment about how Milton said that this is a, and he gives some rationale for it, basically says, "Oh, it's an exuberance of life force. Basically, it's punishment from God." Okay? But he gets so worked up and so angry and so outraged that turns into a giant bug. I'm sorry, I've messed myself and now I'm a bug. And the secretary who finishes the letter form is Toadpipe. You gotta love these names. Toadpipe, for his abysmal sublimity, Undersecretary Screwtape. T-E-B-S, etc. Gotta love it. Okay. So letter 23. Letter 23. Beware the historical Jesus. How many of you have ever heard of the historical Jesus? Anybody? Okay. Every year around Easter time, sometimes around Christmas, you hear of the Jesus Seminar. Anybody ever hear of the Jesus Seminar? Time Magazine will put out, or Life Magazine will put out, or Newsweek put out a quest for the historical Jesus. They hear about the Jesus Seminar. If you watch the History Channel enough, they'll put out something and you'll see the Jesus Seminar, these people doing something about it. It's this group of scholars who try and investigate and see what Jesus really said or who Jesus really was, or and it's kind of hogwash. You can go look into it yourself, but I'd advise you not to, and here's why. Over the last 70 years, they've gotten worse and worse and worse. But Lewis, through Screwtape, gives a really clear reason why. Anyway, for a long time, it will be quite impossible to remove spirituality from his life. Very well, then. We must corrupt it. The world and the flesh have failed us. So we tried to lure him with baubles and gaudy life and all that the world can offer, and that failed. We tried to throw women at him. That failed. And so let's try the third power. Success of this third power is the most glorious kind of all, and that would be a spoiled saint, a Pharisee, an inquisitor, or a magician makes a much better sport in hell than a mere common tyrant or debauchee, somebody who's into debauchery.